Foundations were laid in the peace and security which was won for the nation, and in the extension of its power and influence, giving command of all the main trade routes. It was, however, a civilization which displayed all the evils of a society making haste to be rich. Extremes of wealth and poverty, which had been impossible under an agrarian society, were dividing the nation. The pursuit of commerce encouraged the development of cities and city life, and it was to the cities that the landless farmers migrated in search of a livelihood, where wealth, luxury, and vice dwelt side by side with poverty, misery, and squalor. With the exchange of goods went the exchange of ideas. New religious cults, standards of luxury and splendor, and materialistic aims of living, which had hitherto been foreign, were now introduced. If you think that I am giving you a brief thumbnail sketch of the last 100 years of American life, if you think that I am referring to the beginning of the 20th century and what has transpired in this nation in terms of moving from an agrarian society to an urban society, moving from a society that was based on the farm, on the land, on agriculture, to a commercial urban society, you're partially right. Because I am referring to that, and yet what I read you was not intended to refer to that. What I read you is taken from the introduction to the book of Micah in the Sansino commentary, which is a Jewish commentary. And those who wrote that commentary do not understand the identity of modern-day Israel. They have no idea, no conception, that the United States and British people represent the modern-day 10 tribes of Israel. This commentary, this introduction to the book of Micah, was written, I left out, see, just a few words when I read it, so as to not give entirely away. The way that I read it, the first half of the century, I didn't say which century, they read it, it's written here, the 8th century witnessed the emergence in Israel and Judah of a commercial civilization of great material prosperity. They have reference here to the events that took place in approximately the last 100 years, the last really about 75 or 80 years prior to the collapse and the captivity of northern Israel. Well, the point that I want to bring out, brethren, and the reason I read this and I bring out to you, what we have here, what I've read, not only describes modern-day America, modern-day Israel, it describes ancient Israel, it describes our forebearers. It describes exactly what they went through. And when we go through and understand, have you ever wondered why? You know, the records, the things that are written down in the Bible, the minor prophets, let's take specifically. You know, those men were men who lived at that time, in that age, in that society. They had a message that had impact for their time. They delivered a message for their people at that time. Now, their message had an impact far beyond that day. That's why their message was set down so that we can read it and apply it in our lives today. That's why some of those prophecies are preserved in the Scripture. But to properly understand the prophecy and its implications for today, we have to understand the background against which it is set. We have to understand the background in which it was written. We have to understand the circumstances that they were writing in to really understand their message, and then to understand it for us today. Because, brethren, when we look into it, what we find was exactly the same situation, exactly the same sins, exactly the same problems that were committed by our ancient forebears. And we find God raised up a work, and He gave to them a message. And that same message, God has raised up a work to give today. Same sin, same message, same result. Because you see, Israel of old went into captivity. And there is a parallel Now, when we go through and we understand, and I want to kind of paint the picture a little bit for you, and to help you understand the parallel that exists, and the parallel that exists between God's work then and God's work now, the parallel that exists between Israel and the setting that they were in at that time and the setting that they are in at this time today. And then to understand a little more fully the message and the impact of the message that God gives, particularly through three prophets, Hosea, Amos, and Micah, men who were contemporary with each other, men who were leaders in God's work at that time, whose messages have been set down for us today, and whose messages have a very vital impact on the times, the events that we, brethren, are going to be living through in the weeks, months, and years immediately ahead of us. And it's something certainly that we need to understand and that we need to comprehend. So I want us to understand the message and its implications for us today. Now, there are a lot of parallels that can be drawn. If you want to get basically a survey of the history of the United States, you realize in 1790, which was the first year a census was taken in the United States, there were 600,000 families in the United States. I think that's interesting, you know, no great giant spiritual significance, but I think it's interesting. What population did Israel start off with when God brought them into the Promised Land? 600,000, didn't he? 600,000 men, 600,000 families. That's the population this nation started off with. And when this nation started off back in 1790, this nation was 90% rural. 90% of those 600,000 people lived on a farm. Now, we went through a change. The first 100 years, the change was moderate. From 1790 to 1890, the percentage living on a farm had gone from 90% to 70%. In 100 years, a drop of 20%. Now, from 1890 to 1900, 10 years, all of a sudden it had gone from 70% rural to 60% rural. Now, in 1970, the figure was 25% rural. It began a very rapid decline by World War I. We were kind of on the balance. In the aftermath of that, the population began flooding into the cities, and in the aftermath of World War II, it really multiplied as people came off the farms. We changed from a rural society to an urban society. Now, there came a multiplication of commerce, wealth, and urbanization, and they all go hand in hand together. You see, brethren, the message that God's prophets gave at that time were aimed at a people who were living a certain way, who were committing certain sins. They lived in a society which was geared contrary to God's way. And they are indicted for certain sins they were committed, for a certain way of life that they were living. Now, these messages have implication for us today because we are living the same way as a nation. We're committing the same sins. We're doing the same things. Therefore, the message has impact for us, has meaning for us. There was a history, if you want to go back to Israel. You know, it's interesting, from the time Israel rebelled against the house of David and established its independence, that was approximately 922 B.C. It lasted 200 years, or just over 200 years. And then came the Assyrian invasion, 721 to 718, if you want to check it out, you'll find it was a 3.5-year period, which was the type of time of Jacob's trouble when Israel went into captivity, when the nation was destroyed. That's interesting. You know, Israel of old rebelled against the house of David and established their independence under Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And they lasted as an independent nation 200 years, or just over 200 years, approximately 200 years. You know, it's interesting, our forebears also rebelled against the house of David. Now, you know, interesting the reasons. Why did Israel of old rebel against the house of David? Taxes, wasn't it? They didn't like the taxation program of Rehoboam. You know, Solomon's was bad and Rehoboam's was going to be worse. They said, you know, taxation without representation, you know. They sent their representatives and Rehoboam wouldn't hear them. Does that sound familiar? You know, have you gone back and you read the story of what happened? Same thing, see. We've been griping about that, and God warned through Samuel when the nation wanted to, when Israel of old wanted to set up an independent kingdom outside of the government of God, under, you know, human government. Samuel warned them. He said, there are three things you're going to gripe about, and God is never going to give you any relief from them. You're going to be griping about taxes, you're going to be griping about the bureaucracy, and you're going to be griping about military conscription. And, you know, all of the things that go with those things. You can go back and read it in the book of 1 Samuel. I'm not going to turn back there. I think I have gone through it before. You know, the first thing Saul did was institute the income tax. Fourth tithe. You ever heard of fourth tithe? That's what Saul instituted. A 10% levy all across the board on everybody. And it went up from there. That's what they started out with, see. By the time of Solomon, they said the taxation is oppressive. You wonder how high it got. You know, if it started out that way with Saul, how long in 120 years? From the beginning of Saul's reign to the end of Solomon's reign was 120 years. How high do you think taxes had gotten in that time? Probably about like Britain is today. So the people rebelled. They rebelled then, they rebelled in our day, and they set up a nation. And it's interesting, we've come approximately 200 years. But from the time that we rebelled against the house of David until the time of our captivity, I'm not setting any specific date. You don't have to use 1776 to start from. You know, that's when we started. It took us a few years to win our independence. You were all on up to, about 1781, somewhere right in that neighborhood. And so, we're talking of an approximate 200-year period. I'm not setting some date, things are going to work out, you know, exactly one way or the other. But I think we realize, and I don't have to go through a whole sermon to prove we're the last generation. And I can prove that, and I think there are many things that certainly prove that this is the end time and the end generation that God is going to usher in, the return of Jesus Christ and the setting up of God's government on this earth in our lifetime. So we're talking of an approximate period of 200 years. Then it's interesting, we started out with about the same number of people. We started out as a totally agrarian society with, you know, just a few towns, a few cities. We have multiplied, and as the wealth and the prosperity multiplied, and the time of this really began during the reign in ancient Israel of Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II, whose reign began approximately 60 years before the collapse of Israel. Now, if you want to go back about 60 years, we're talking about the time period, you know, to parallel it with our times today, of right after World War I, that Israel began to achieve its real place. I'm talking about northern Israel. And, you know, perhaps we haven't gone into and studied history in the Old Testament enough to really glean the full impact of some of these prophecies and the parallels for our time today. But Israel, northern Israel, reached their pinnacle under Jeroboam II, who had a long reign of about 40 years. And in the aftermath of Jeroboam II's reign, there were six kings in 25 years. It was a very unstable time period. I think, again, it's interesting. You know, in the time period since 1960, since Dwight Eisenhower, you realize he's the last president to serve two full terms? Ever thought about that? You know, John Kennedy was elected and he was assassinated. Lyndon Johnson succeeded to his unexpired term, won a tremendous victory, and then went right on to bog the nation down in the Vietnam War, and such internal strife and dissent was stirred up that he was finally virtually forced by the pressure of public opinion and by the internal strife that had been stirred up in this country. He was forced to go on the networks and say, I will not seek the nomination of my party, you know, to run for president again. He was forced to step down. He served out his term, but in the midst of great uproar. If you remember the Democratic National Convention of that year, when Hubert Humphrey was nominated, the riots that shook Chicago and all of the things that took place and the internal strife and turmoil, as this nation was a nation that was being rent asunder and a president virtually forced out of office. All right, then Richard Nixon came in. And he was, finally, completely forced from office to where he became the very first man in the history of the United States of America to resign the office of a president. And he was forced to resign the presidency, succeeded by Gerald Ford, who served out his term and then was defeated for re-election, which is a very rare thing, is only something that has only very occasionally happened in the history of this nation, and last happened when Franklin Roosevelt defeated Herbert Hoover during the time of the Depression, and something that has very rarely happened. And he was defeated for election, succeeded by Jimmy Carter, who appears to be well on his way to being the first president in modern history who will not even be allowed the nomination of his own party. He looks like he's on his way to being beat out. So we have had a very unnatural, unstable setup in our government of just transfer, transfer, transfer. It's interesting. Israel of old did that. And Jeroboam II's 40 years of stability, and then nothing but chaos and confusion followed. Six kings in 25 years. And most of different dynasties. There were several assassinations and various other things. So it's interesting, you know, and I pointed up a parallel, not for you to try to fit every specific thing. I'm pointing up a parallel of general trend. And I'm not trying to draw a specific parallel for every individual or every person. But the nation of northern Israel expanded during the time of Jeroboam II. They expanded their borders. They controlled the strategic gates. And as commerce multiplied, materialism multiplied. And there came to be many problems that beset the nation, that beset the people. Many sins that came to beset that nation. And it was something that brought it to the fore when God raised up his prophets. Now, Hosea, who was the first of those prophets, began his prophecy. Hosea began his prophecy at a period of about 50 years before the collapse of Israel. Hosea began his prophecy. Hosea and Amos and Micah were a little bit later, but during the same lifetime. Hosea's ministry was about a 50-year ministry. Interesting. It began at the time when Israel was reaching her peak, was just, you know, just at the point of attaining her peak of power. It began at that time and continued on down until captivity. Now, it's interesting. God raised up this work approximately 50 years ago, not yet 50 years, let's say about 45 years ago. God raised up this work, and this work carried a message to this nation at a time when this nation and when Britain were reaching the pinnacle of their power. We as a nation stood unchallenged in supremacy at the end of World War II. We possessed the bomb. We were the only nation that possessed the bomb. Britain also possessed the information. They had worked with us on it. We possessed the bomb. We had the army. We had the navy. We had the factories that were geared up. We had the world's strongest economy. The United States stood supreme. The United States and Britain possessed the vast majority of all of the world's wealth. We had the power to dominate and rule the world. And this work, you know, it's interesting that this work really went nationwide on radio in 1945. Now, we had been a daily part of the time during World War II. We had gone, I guess technically nationwide in the sense we began on WAI back in 42. And I think WHO Des Moines and whatever at various other times, and we reached a lot of areas in the nation. We went on XEG in 1945 and really began from that time forward to saturate the nation on a daily basis with the World Tomorrow broadcast during the closing time of World War II. And we were talking about, Mr. Herbert Armstrong was a lone voice crying in the wilderness that Germany will rise again. And some of you have been around this work going back, you know, for that 30 or 35 years, and some of you have plain truths going back and dated 1945, 1947, 1949, 1951. And there are articles there headlining, Germany will rise again. And he was a voice saying that in 1945, when Germany was being pummeled, when Germany was being pounded out of existence, and he was saying this nation had better repent or it is going to be defeated and carried into captivity, taking the message of Hosea, of Amos, of Micah. Those men began delivering their message at a time when their nation was standing at the pinnacle. And they began to give that message. Because you see, those people were committing certain sins. And God says, whatsoever you sow, that shall you also reap. Ask any farmer. You go and sow corn, and what do you reap? You don't get broccoli. You get corn. You reap what you sow. As a nation, we have sowed certain things. And we, brethren, are reaping certain things and will reap certain things. Israel of old sowed certain things. And they did reap certain things. That is a matter of history. And there is an enormous parallel between our forebears and our nation today. Let's turn to the book of Hosea, chapter 4. Let's begin to see what God has to say for our people. Hosea, chapter 4, verse 1. Hear the word of the Eternal, you children of Israel, for the Eternal has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. God has a controversy with our people because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood touches blood. In other words, one violent act, one murder leads to another. You know, just flowing like a river. Therefore shall the land mourn, and every one that dwells therein shall languish with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven, yea, and the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. Do we find that happening today? You think the fish of the sea are even being taken away? We've got an oil spill down off the Gulf of Mexico. The fish of the sea are being taken away. The fowls of heaven, the beasts of the field are languishing. You know, we have polluted our nation. We have polluted our land, and we are destroying our heritage. The choicest bounties of heaven. You've forgotten. You've gone a different way. You've sown the wind and you'll reap the whirlwind. Brethren, we need to realize this. Our people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge. I will also reject you. That you shall be no priest to me, seeing that you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. God says his people, Israel, are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Why lack of knowledge? Because they rejected knowledge. Our peoples nationally have not even acted on the things they know. They know better than what they're doing. And there may be things that they don't understand, but I'll guarantee you there are a lot of things they do understand. You know, 98% of the homes in this nation have a Bible in them. 98% of the homes also have a television set. That's an interesting statistic. Approximately, you know, just almost identically, the same number of homes possess Bibles as possess television sets. What do you think people, you know, what do you think is on the majority of the day? Well, what do you think those 98%? How many hours do you think that 98% spends reading the Bible as opposed to watching television? What do you think the comparison is? I think probably, you know, about equal, and you read the Bible for an hour and watch television for an hour, don't you kid yourself. Probably a lot of those 98% would have trouble finding that Bible Oh, yeah, they know where it is. It's on the table there under the vase, you know. It's got the little doily sitting on top of it with the flowers. You know, that's where the Bible is. You know just where it is. You know, we dust it off every year when we have spring cleaning. The outside, not the inside. But, oh, don't let that television set go out. Call the repairman. Get him here quick. An emergency. You know, it's midnight. The late movie's on. I'm going to miss it. You got to get here. You know, house call. You wouldn't find them rushing down to the bookstore to buy a Bible if something happened to theirs. You know, they'd probably go a year and not even think about it. But they can't do that with a television set. But, you know, God says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because they've rejected knowledge. Now, there is no lack of technical knowledge available today. There's all kind of knowledge. There is a proliferation of knowledge. But it is the wrong kind of knowledge. God says, by swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery and all of this kind of thing, by a rampant violation of the commandments of God. God says in verse 7, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. As they were increased, so they sinned against me. You know, our sins as a nation have multiplied in proportion to our blessings. The more God has blessed us, the more wealth we've received, the more of God's blessings that have been poured out upon us, the more corrupt we have become as a nation. The more our immorality, the more our greed, the more our covetousness, the more our sins nationally have multiplied. And you can run it out. You can go back and take the crime statistics, and you can take the divorce rate, and you can take various of these things and project them out from 1900 on up. And it is absolutely staggering what has taken place. God says, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. The more I've blessed you, the more I've poured out the choicest bounty of heaven on top of you. What have you done with it? God says, verse 11, whoredom and wine and new wine have taken away the heart. You know, whoredom. Immorality. Sexual looseness, which is a plague in this nation today. A lot of people don't even begin to take seriously. And I'm afraid, brethren, some of this attitude even affects some of God's people and even some of our, we as parents certainly need to be aware because that our children have God's viewpoint on these things. I want to tell you that this society, immorality is so rampant in this society, people don't even take it seriously anymore. There's no such thing as disgrace anymore. Whoredom and wine and new wine. You know, what are people into today, to use the modern term? Well, they're into all types of immorality, and they're into all types of drug and alcohol abuse. You know, and it all the same category, in terms of drug and alcohol abuse. It takes away the heart. This is what people are caught up in. This is what the nation is saturated with. My people ask counsel at their stocks, and their staff declares for them. For the spirit of whoredom has caused them to err, and they've gone a-whoring from their God. Now, what is that talking about? They ask counsel of their stocks and their staff. I want to read you a comment in the Jewish commentary. Their stock means the wooden idols fashioned by their craftsmen, their staff. So depraved have the people grown that they no longer consult the priests, but have recourse to divination by stick. Now, when you check it up, what it's talking about astrology. It's talking about that kind of thing. Divination, all kinds of, you know, Ouija boards and astrology. Boy, astrology charts, you go in stores and they got all these chains and pendants hanging around Pisces and Aquarius and all this kind of garbage, all this kind of thing. It's an abomination in God's sight. You can go back, you don't trace that kind of thing back to Babylon, and I don't want to get into that part of it. But God said, you know, that's what happened. People don't seek to me for the way they ought to live their lives. They seek to their horoscope. They seek to, you know, in effect, all types of divination and fortune tellers and all kinds of demonism. And this is the kind of thing that people are seeking to. The spirit of whoredoms has caused them to err. You know, just an absolute depraved state of mind. And I think it just sometimes it's hard for us to grasp the enormity of the sin that God looks down and sees, and the fact that it is an absolute stench in the nostrils of Almighty God. And I think sometimes we get so hardened to it, we get so callous to it, and we've seen so much of it on television and other things, that we just get callous to it. And after a while, well, you know, big deal. Don't get shook up about that. I'm going to tell you something, brethren. God doesn't have that kind of attitude looking at it. But that rubs off on us, and we begin to not... It just is not that big a deal anymore, and we don't get that worked up about it, and it doesn't bother us. And sometimes our children take it a lot more casually than we do. We take it casually enough, and they are bombarded by it, and it just is something that we need to make sure that we have God's viewpoint on it, because it is destroying a people. It is sapping our... It's sapping our vitality. It's sapping our national strength. We are destroying ourselves by what we're doing. We've rejected knowledge. Well, God goes on and talks about this kind of thing. He talks about verse 16, Israel slides back as a backsliding heifer. Now the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place. Makes the point very plain in terms of what has transpired and what is transpiring in our nation. Hosea chapter 8, God says, set the trumpet to your mouth. Well, that's a command to us. God tells his servants back in Isaiah 58, cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet, and show my people their sins, and the house of Jacob their transgressions. That is our responsibility, brethren. Set the trumpet to your mouth. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Eternal, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Israel shall cry unto me, my God, we know you. Oh, we're God-fearing folk. Oh, we're a godly nation. 90% of the people in this nation believe in God. That's what George Gallup says. 98% of the people in this country have a Bible in their home. Oh, we're a godly people. God says Israel has cast off the thing that is good. The enemy shall pursue him. They've set up kings, but not by me. They've made princes, and I knew it not. Of their silver and their gold have they made them idols, but they may be cut off. We set our affection on material things. Our silver and our gold are what's important to us. Money. Material wealth. God goes on to say, verse 7, they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. It has no stalk, the bud shall yield no meal. If it yields, strangers shall swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now shall they be among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. For they are gone up to Assyria, a wild ass alone by himself. Ephraim has hired lovers. You read about the Commonwealth Conference over in Lusaka. Over in Africa, you read about the Commonwealth Conference. Britain went there, you know, hat in hand to its former colonies. It hired itself lovers. Oh, they tried to appease and to get allies. And oh, please, Nigeria, don't take away our oil wells that we have there in your country, Nigeria. You know, to show absolute total contempt that Nigeria, a part of the Commonwealth, had for Britain. On the opening day of the Commonwealth Conference, Nigeria nationalized all of the British oil holdings in Nigeria. Well, that's just the way they started it off, and say, hey, this is what we think of you, you know. Snap our fingers under your nose. We'll just show you what we think of you. And you better sit back and you better like it, buddy. Because we're not going to take anything off you. We don't have to put up with you. Israel is swallowed up. Israel has lost the pride of its power. Israel finds that the things God has given are draining away. And they don't know what to do. And they appease and they compromise. They've sown the wind and they'll reap the whirlwind. God says they're swallowed up. They'll be among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. You know, we're an unpopular lot. The United States and Britain are not going to win any popularity contest around the world. We are among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. Oh, they get a little pleasure now and then out of, hauling our flag down and spitting on it, or nationalizing some of our property, or kind of thumbing their nose in our face. We're among the Gentiles as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. Well, what did Britain do? They went to Assyria. They go to Germany to bail them out. Ephraim is hired lovers. They're using that North Sea oil, and they think that's going to win friends for them. God says, yea, though they've hired among the nations, now will I gather them, and they shall sorrow a little for the burden of the king of princes, because Ephraim has made many altars to sin. Altars shall be unto him to sin. And it goes on down, verse 14. For Israel has forgotten his maker and builded temples, and Judah has multiplied fenced cities, but I will send a fire upon his cities, and it shall devour the palaces thereof. Israel has forgotten his maker and builds temples. Doesn't that describe us? We've forgotten God. We've forgotten the true God and his law and his way. And oh, do we build temples. We build churches, and we've got them coming out our ears. You can read one going up in California, and it's an all-glass church. You know, I guess people who live in glass houses shouldn't cast stones or something like that. You know, I read an article on that just recently, and they got this mammoth thing going up to all the glass. Everything, supposedly, is of glass. Now, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but anyway, that's what they're doing. Well, that's fine. That's their thing. But boy, has Israel multiplied temples. We got churches all over the place, but we've forgotten our Maker. We don't serve God and obey God, but we build churches all over the place. Now, the Jews are a little more realistic. They multiply fenced cities. They put their trust in all of their armaments. They multiply their fenced cities, their various armaments and munitions and all of the various things that they had. They multiply that kind of thing. God says, I'm going to send a fire upon his cities. You're going to find out your fenced cities are not going to do you any good. So it goes on and it talks about the things that are going to transpire. Let's go on over to the book of Amos. Better hurry along. Amos chapter 2, verse 6. For thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. They pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way of the meek, and a man and his father go in unto the same woman to profane my holy name. Now, what's that talking about? They sell the poor for a pair of shoes. I want to read a little more out of the Jewish commentary. I think it perhaps will help to amplify and to bring out some of these things. Amos chapter 2 talks about selling the poor for a pair of shoes. This is a reference to the ancient legal procedure of the transfer of a shoe to symbolize the transfer of property. You remember the account given back in Ruth, Mr. Rosler referred to in the sermonette, you know, of how, of course, the transaction that took place. And if you remember the story in the book of Ruth, when Boaz took over the right of the kinsman redeemer and bought the land, the other fellow took off his shoe and gave it to him. It symbolized the transfer of property. Well, the sense of this verse, and that they've sold the poor for a pair of shoes, in other words, that exploiters cloak their unscrupulous transactions with legal formality. They went through the form. They went through the legal formality, but it all amounted to the same thing. They exploited. They swallowed up the poor. Goes on down, and they pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor. Reading again from the Jewish commentary, their land hunger is so great that they desire even the dust which rests on the poor man's head. You know, they're swallowing up everything around. They swallow up the land that belongs to the poor and virtually covet the dust of it that he has left on his head. You know, they're out to get everything there is. So God says, so he talks about the greed and the corruption, the economic sins, the materialism is one chief indictment, and the sexual immorality, the sexual looseness. These are two main things that God goes into. So he goes on and he talks about this kind of thing here in Amos chapter 2, going on over in Amos chapter 8. Amos chapter 8 and verse 4. Hear this, O you that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone, that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath that we may set forth wheat? Making the ephah small and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat. The Eternal has sworn by the excellency of Jacob, surely I will not forget any of their works. God says, O you that swallow up the needy, that make the poor of the land to fail. And he goes on, and he talks about making the ephah small and the shekel great. Now, the ephah was the measurement of produce, like a bushel. The shekel was a measurement of money, like a dollar. God, what's he talking about? What is the thing that oppresses the poor of the land more than any other factor in terms of the economic system that we have? That is inflation. And inflation is manufactured. And inflation is intentional, and I can prove that not only from history and from fact, I can prove it from the Scripture too in terms of what God says and in terms of certain prophecies, Babylon the Great and the economic aspects of that. I don't want to get into that all of that today. But what is inflation? Selling less and less and getting more and more for it. God says you're making the ephah small and the shekel great. You're selling less and getting more. That is the cruelest tax of all, and those who pay it, who does it hit the hardest? Some of you sitting here in this room know. Those who are on fixed income, the widows, the fatherless, those that God says we ought to look out for, those that God says ought to be taken care of, the elderly, the poor of the land, those that are needy, are being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. God says, warn the thing that make the ephah small and the shekel great, falsifying the balances by deceit. You know, it was interesting. This scripture came to my mind. I was up in Canada this summer, and I was noticing the prices up on the gas stations. $21.9, $22.9. That wasn't gallons. That was liters. And they switched over, and I was talking with my father-in-law about it, and they switched over to the metric system. I was talking with him in the various measurements. You know, they don't sell half gallons of milk anymore. They sell 2-liter boxes. And, of course, it's not an exact equivalent. And you know what? Of course, they took advantage of the opportunity to do was to kind of confuse the issue. They switched over to a different system of measurement. But if you get out and do all the calculations and compare back and forth, you find out they raised the price while they did it, and they stuck it to you a little more. But they changed the measurement and the price, and so people didn't realize, you know, they tried to make the boxes look. You take a 2-liter box of milk and a half-gallon box of milk, and you can't tell the difference unless you place them side by side. They made it look exactly the same. They priced it that way, too. Exactly the same. But it wasn't as much. Falsifying the balances by deceit. Just a whole deceitful attitude. We're going to gig them one way or the other. He's talking about an attitude, a concept that pervades. Well, this type of an attitude, hear this, O you that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail. We're going to get, and we're going to get, and we're going to get. God says, I'm not going to forget. I'm not going to forget what you're doing. You may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, to sell the refuse of the wheat. Willing to sell anything, willing to make shady deals, this type of a corrupt approach. You know, we're reaping the whirlwind on these things. God talks about in Amos chapter 3 and verse 9, he says, behold the great tumults in the midst thereof, and the oppressions in the midst thereof. The great tumult, the civil strife that we are having in our nations, that we're having inside the United States, that we're having inside Canada, and inside Britain, and inside South Africa. inside Australia, the civil strife, all of the turmoil, the internal turmoil, the great tumult in the land, in the midst thereof, inside. Our problems are internal problems. The problems of Israel are internal problems. When Ephraim saw his sickness, it is an internal problem. I want to read you a little bit. I mentioned in terms of inflation, and I think you need to understand a little bit about that. I have an article here from the Christian Science Monitor, which is very good, and it points up a little bit and explains something about it, because there are all kind of ideas going around who causes inflation and what causes inflation. And there's only one. There's only one. It gets back to one aspect in terms of controlling inflation, because it gets back to the cause. Congress has managed to balance the federal budget only once since 1960. You know, rather dubious accomplishment. How would you like it? You know, if you and I tried to run, if you had run your financial affairs the way Congress runs the nation, what would you, you know, you've managed to balance your budget once since 1960, they'd have you locked up somewhere. You would have had to file for bankruptcy or something. Sometimes the deficits have been small, but for the past 5 years, this is written in 78, Congress has spent $30 billion to $60 billion a year more than it has taken in. If you and I did that, it would be called writing a hot check, you know. So they arrest people for things like that. They prosecute them for things like that. The federal government has to pay its bills even when it has a deficit. One way it does so is by creating new money. Instead, now they don't do this. You think, well, you know, just crank up the printing presses and print more. Well, no, it's worse than that. It's worse than that. Instead of printing more currency, it does what amounts to the same thing. Actually, it's worse in a roundabout way. First, the federal government sells government securities to the Federal Reserve Corporation. Now, the Federal Reserve Corporation is a privately owned, quasi-government agency, but it is privately owned. There are shares in the Federal Reserve system, and they're owned, you know, various bankers, and it is the only corporation in the United States whose stockholder, you know, the record of the stockholders is secret. And you can't, you know, other corporations, you can investigate and you can find out who owns the stock. Not so with the Federal Reserve. It's the only one, and the secrecy of it is protected by law. And that's a different story, and it goes back to some things that happened back at the turn of the century. Anyway, the Federal Government sells government securities to the Federal Reserve. In other words, they print up bonds. Interest-bearing bonds, and they sell those bonds to the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve is the one that creates the currency. If you look on your dollars, it says a Federal Reserve note. See, they're issued by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve pays for these securities by making a deposit in the name of the federal government and a Federal Reserve Bank. They're the ones that create the money. And you read in the newspaper about the Fed is going to increase the supply of money or decrease the supply of money. The federal government goes to the Federal Reserve and they say, we need, you know, $10 billion. And so they print up $10 million worth of bonds. The Federal Reserve buys those bonds, but where do they get the money to buy it? They print them. See, they're the ones that run the press. They print the $10 billion. They deposit, you know, the way they do it, they take $10 billion in bonds, they deposit to the account of the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve Bank $10 billion, and then the government writes checks on those $10 billion that the Federal Reserve just created for them. But the Federal Reserve then has $10 billion in bonds, interest-bearing bonds. As the federal government needs money, it simply writes checks on its Federal Reserve accounts. You know, how would you like to do that? Keep going down and doing that, all right? Thus, new dollars are created and placed into circulation in the economy, but every other dollar is worth less as a result, because you got more and more dollars chasing the same amount or even less goods. Now, that's not even the whole thing. That's not even the whole story. The article doesn't go on and amplify. But what does the Federal Reserve then do with that with that $10 billion of bonds that it has? Well, in the first place, you know what? The banks have to keep 10%. They can loan out $9 on every, or what is it? 9 to 1. They keep 10%. In other words, for the $10 billion which the federal government now has deposited in the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve is able to loan out at interest $90 billion, say, based on those reserves that it has, those assets, and collect the interest off of all of that. Then the $10 billion it has in bonds from the federal government has to pay the interest on those bonds. You know what the interest on $10 billion worth of bonds is? You know, do a little figuring. That mounts up to some money itself. All right. What it amounts to is, thanks to inflation and the graduated income tax, Americans today, pay 42% of their incomes in local, state, and federal taxes. Now, inflation is an increase in the money supply which exceeds the increase in the value of goods and services produced in the economy. We see inflation as a general rise in prices or an erosion of the purchasing power of the dollar. But these are merely effects of inflation, effects of the growth of the money supply. Congress rarely votes to raise our taxes. It doesn't need to. If we simply keep up with inflation in our earnings, we move into higher tax brackets because of the graduated nature of the federal income tax system. Now, you see, the Federal Reserve does not have to worry about collecting its debt. The IRS is the collection agency. See, they make sure that the government gets the money in to pay the interest. We're not paying on the national debt. We're simply paying interest on the national debt. This fiscal year of 78, Americans will pay $55 billion in interest on the national debt. We're not even paying on that anymore. We're just paying the interest on the national debt, making interest on the national debt the third largest category of federal spending. Spiraling inflation. It goes on down, talking about the fact that only government can increase the money supply, only government can stabilize it. It's, there are various things. There's an article here from U.S. News about the fact of federal debt fast approaching $1 trillion. You know, that's an astronomical figure that we can't even comprehend. This is talking about, this was written in January 1978. It's past the trillion mark now. This article is soon going to be 2 years old, and it talks about the rapid rise in federal debt. And you can't see the figures on it, but look at the graph. Figured from 1776 to 1978, you know, 200 years, and look at the rise. You know, it's peaking out. Well, it can't continue to go on that way. I want to read you a little bit from an old book printed back in 1924, and it's interesting. This is an article on money, and it's interesting from this standpoint how much times have changed. We're talking about 1924, what's that, 55 years ago. Talks about the fact that the first attempt, is talking about money, the first attempt to fix value of pieces of metal used as money was by weighing them. Scales were used in drawing ancient bargains. So that's why God uses the analogy in Scripture, falsifying the balances, making the ephah small and the shekel great. That's the symbolism that's involved, because that was the early way of fixing the price of money, was by weighing it. Now, I want to read you just a paragraph on Rome. There was little money coming into the Roman treasuries in the latter days, but vast sums were being spent for luxury. Silks for the women were worth their weight in gold, and more than $400,000 annually went out of Rome to the east for splendid clothes, gems, spices, and oils. To offset this loss, the emperors, beginning with Nero, began to mix cheaper metals in the coin. It was the same state of things as if the President of the United States should take one-third of the silver out of our dollars and substitute 10! Exclamation point. 10, T-I-N. At last, the denarius was only copper-coated with tin and was officially called no good by the government, which was a plain admission of bankruptcy. The gold coin was also reduced to almost half its original weight. Have you seen one of the new Susan B. Anthony dollars? This was written in 1924, and they wrote that as, boy, you know, can you imagine the emperor taking the gold out of the coins and substituting copper? That'd be just as ridiculous as the president taking the silver out of our coins and you know, making them out of tin instead.
That's right, sure would.
Same thing, isn't it? The thing is, you know, 55 years later, that's what we're doing. In 1924, that was, you know, that was crazy. They used that as an example, and people would look at that and think, boy, you know, isn't that crazy? Can you imagine someone doing such a thing? They couldn't then. We can now. And well, look at the quarters. You got, you know, the sand, it looks like a sandwich. You know, the copper in there, and you got a little, you know, something on either side. And the dollar, we've even made it smaller. They have the dollar out. And the new dollar, I haven't even seen one. They're not circulating too well. But anyway, they're just barely larger than a quarter. And I think that's interesting because, you know, they should have made it about the size of a dime if they wanted to accurately reflect what's happened in the last few years. You know, it's incredible. And brethren, we need to understand, we need to realize everyone does not suffer the effects of inflation the same way. Everyone does not suffer the effects of depression the same way. There are those who are exploiting the poor for gain. Now, it's interesting, there's an article here in U.S. News and World Report about why an old theory of economic ups and downs worries the West. And it shows on graph form kind of an up and down cycle of expansion and stagnation, and it goes up and down. The stagnation represents a time of depression and then expansion. And it's interesting that this is based on about a 50-year cycle. Bottomed out after the country began, bottomed out in the late 1820s, bottomed out in the late 1870s, bottomed out in you know, the early 1930s. You know, let's see, 50 years later, what would that bring us to? Sometime right in the near future. It's interesting, approximately every 50 years. You know, man is sure a lot smarter than God. Man has a way of figuring out a much better economic system than what God had. You know what God had every 50 years? God had a jubilee. Man, you know, that's crazy. Have a jubilee, we'll have a depression every 50 years. That's a lot better. You know, why have an old jubilee when everybody's happy? Why don't we have a depression? Let it all, instead of all coming back to those whose right it is, let it all go into the hands of a few. You know, some of you lived through the last depression. You know what happened. There were fortunes made in the depression. Oh, there were fortunes lost. Those were the ones that weren't in on the nose. There were those that came out of the depression multiplying their wealth in terms of actual holdings. God indicts our nation for involvement in many of these things and for allowing our government to be corrupted. God tells us that we and in Israel are in Babylon, a Babylonian system, and the whole system of our economic system goes back to Babylon. This is a very interesting book from that standpoint, written over 50 years ago, and it goes into the history of the economic system and is very, very good in that way. It's been out of print for many years, the old Outline of Knowledge series, which was you know, in vogue back at that time. But you know, there are places we can go on. We can go on in the book of Micah chapter 3, verse 9. Hear this, I pray you, you sons, you heads of the house of Jacob and princes of the house of Israel, that abhor judgment and pervert all equity. What God has to say about our judicial system. They build up Zion with blood and Jerusalem with iniquity. The heads thereof judge for reward, and the priests thereof teach for hire, and the prophets thereof divine for money. Yet will they lean upon the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? None evil can come upon us. Oh, we're a good people. We're a godly people. Oh, God is among us. We know that God won't let anything happen to us. We're such good folk. Don't kid yourself. God says that this is an indictment in terms of our judicial system. He says that as he looks at it, we abhor judgment and pervert all equity. He says that we've got people who are in it for the money, whether judges or whether even those that are supposed to claim to represent God, even the ministry. Now he said, God says, therefore shall Zion be for your sake be plowed as a field, and Jerusalem shall become heaps, and the mountains of the house as the high places of the forest. So God says that indictment is going to come on us. We see, we can go on back Micah chapter 6, verse 2, Hear, O mountains, the Eternal's controversy, you strong foundations of the earth, for the Eternal has a controversy with His people, and He will plead with Israel. And he goes on and he talks about what God has done. And it says, will God be pleased, verse 7, with thousands of rams or with 10,000 of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? You think God's going to be pleased with going through the ritual of religion? He has showed you, O man, what is good and what does the Eternal require of you, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. The Eternal's voice cries unto the city, and a man of wisdom shall see your name, hear you the rod, and who has appointed it. He goes on talking about various indictments of the nation, going on back in Micah chapter 7, as it goes through and talks about, again, the problems. Verse 2, the good man is perished out of the earth. There's none upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. They hunt every man his brother with a net. Everybody's seeking to trip up everyone else. That they may do evil with both hands earnestly. The prince asks, the judge asks for a reward. The great man, he utters his mischievous desire, so they wrap it up, you know, in just all neat little package, all kind of chicanery. The best of them is as a briar. The most upright is sharper than a thorn hedge. You want to get involved in politics? You want to go out and elect old so-and-so, get him in? God says the best of them is as a briar. The most upright is sharper than a thorn hedge. Now that's what God has to say about them. Maybe you think you know more and you're going to go out and get so-and-so elected. He's going to solve the problems. I'm going to tell you something. No, he's not. You know, Nebuchadnezzar learned that God set over nations whomsoever he would, sometimes even the basest of men. Nebuchadnezzar learned that lesson, that God was the one that was really ruling in the affairs of men, and God would set up whoever he wanted, even the basest of men, and God's allowed some of the basest of men to be in many offices. And we're not going to affect that. So, verse 6, the son dishonors the father, the daughter rises up against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own house. We've got family problems. We've got families tearing apart. We've got disrespect to children for parents. We've got a breakdown of the family. We've got the family, the American family, sacrificed on the altar of materialism in this nation. God says you've sown the wind and you're going to reap the whirlwind. And he talks about the results. He talks about the things that are going to come on. He talks about in Micah 3:4, then shall they cry unto the Eternal, and he will not hear them. He will even hide his face from them at that time, as they have behaved themselves ill in their doing. God says the time's going to come when people are going to cry out, and oh, woe is us. God help us, and God's not going to hear. He talks about in Amos chapter 4, the fact in verse 6, I've given you cleanness of teeth in all your cities and want of bread in all your places. Talks about in verse 7, I've withheld the rain in some places, and I caused it to rain on another city. One piece was rained upon, and the piece whereupon it rained not withered. Two or three cities wandered unto one city to drink water. You know, one place is flooded, and the other place has drought. But they were not satisfied. Verse 9, I've smitten you with blasting and mildew. Verse 10, I have sent among you the pestilence after the manner of Egypt. You are young men, have I slain with a sword. Verse 11, I've overthrown some of you as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and you were as a firebrand plucked out of the burning, yet have you not returned unto me, says the Eternal. Therefore, thus will I do unto you, O Israel, and because I will do this unto you, prepare to meet your God, O Israel. For lo, he that formed the mountains and created the wind and declared unto man what is his thought, that makes the morning darkness and treads upon the high places of the earth, the Eternal, the God of hosts, is his name. And we are a nation that has forgotten God. And we're a nation that has turned our back on God. And brethren, this nation has got to hear this message. And this nation, which has committed these sins, is going to have some lessons to learn. And God goes on and he talks about the captivity that's going to come, of things that are going to transpire in this nation, and the fact of the deep lessons and the difficult lessons that this nation is going to have to learn. God tells us in Hosea 14, O Israel, return unto the Eternal your God, for you have fallen by your iniquity. Take with you words and take to the Eternal, say unto him, take away all iniquity and receive us graciously, so will we render the calves of our lips. Asher shall not save us. We will not ride upon horses, neither will we say any more to the work of our hands, you are our God, for in you the fatherless find mercy. You know, our people are going to have to come, and they're going to have to be brought down low to come to the point where they cry out to God and they mean it. And they realize, no, Germany's not going to save us. Our allies are not going to bail us out. We're not going to ride upon horses. We're not going to assemble some vast armament and some vast armada, some vast airborne force or missiles or whatever. Neither shall we say any more to the works of our hands, to all of the material things we fixed our attention on. We realize that the things we make are not going to save us. We realize that our material possessions, that's not God. We realize that all the things we've set our affection on, that we've looked to for our deliverance, those things cannot save us. God says to our nation, prepare, O Israel, to meet your God. The Eternal, the Maker of heaven and earth, that's His name. The one that formed the earth, the one that made everything that is. The one you've forgotten, the one you've thrown out of your school, the one you've thrown off the television and out of your media, the one you've taken out of your national life, the one that gave you everything that's worth. Strive nor reprove another, for your people are as they that strive with the priest. Therefore shall they fall in that day, and the prophet also shall fall with them in the night, and I will destroy your mother, or cut her off. In other words, the religion of the people is great. Our nation collectively is part and parcel of this Babylonish system. And if we want to dabble our toes in it, and if we want to get close to it and try to be in it, we need to understand that if we become partakers of the sins of this Babylonian system, we will be partakers in its plagues. God says, come out of her, my people. Be not partakers of her sins, be not partakers of her plagues. Don't get caught up in this idea of grasping, of a covetous, lustful attitude toward life. Don't allow that kind of thing to begin to come in and to permeate you. Don't take God's law lightly. Don't allow these things. God says when the nation repents, then he'll hear. Then he'll listen. He says, I'll heal their backslidings. I will love them freely, for my anger is turned away from them. I'll be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily and cast forth his roots as Lebanon. His branches shall spread and his beauty shall be as the olive tree and his smell as Lebanon. They that dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall revive as the corn and grow as the vine. The scent thereof shall be as the wine of Lebanon. Ephraim shall say, what have I to do any more with idols? I have heard him and observed him. I'm like a green fir tree. From me is your fruit found. Who is wise? He shall understand these things. You want to be wise, brethren? Better understand these things. Prudent, and he shall know them. For the ways of the Lord are right. So it boils down to something very simple. The ways of God are right. Their justice, equity, love, mercy. The laws of God. The ways of the Eternal are right. And the just shall walk in them. But the transgressors shall fall therein. Brethren, that's a lesson we need to drive home to ourselves. That's a lesson whether we be young or old, whether we be teenager or adult. That's a lesson that you need to make a part of you. The ways of God are right. Teenagers, adults, children, whoever. The ways of God are right, and the just shall walk in them. You want to walk in God's ways? I don't care what your age is. You walk in God's ways and you'll be blessed, and you will be able to walk in them. But the transgressors, those who seek to go contrary to the way of God, shall fall therein. You know, God's ways are set down. And God makes us aware of something, and we have a precious message. And we can't afford to draw back. We can't afford to allow our attention to be diverted from the work that God has set before us. And, you know, it's something that we need to understand, we need to apply to us, realizing the seriousness of the calling that we have. Realizing that God sets out a message to our people. As a nation, we've repeated the sins of our ancient forebears. We've virtually repeated their entire history. What's interesting? Put the same people in the same position, and they tend to do the same things. As we have followed in their sin, so we shall receive of their punishment. But brethren, that's not where the story ends. Because when we go through those prophecies, whether in Hosea, whether in Amos, whether in Micah, we see that that's not the end, because beyond the punishment, ultimately lies national repentance and national salvation. And ahead of that lies a great and a glorious future forever. For all of us, for our children, for our grandchildren, for our great-grandchildren, and for generations, 40 generations on down through the millennium. And we, all of us, young and old, have an opportunity to be a part of that. We have an opportunity to be a part of a work that is preparing for the ushering in of a new kingdom, a new government, a new era. The kingdom of God, the government of God, which is going to be restored to this earth. We have an opportunity to usher in that government and to restore God's way. Every one of us, young and old, have an opportunity to participate in that. Brethren, it's a precious thing. It's a thing that the world does not understand and does not esteem. But it's important. And it's something that if we keep it forefront of our minds, of our attitudes, of our affections, it's something that God will give us a part in sharing with all mankind.